I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio, and my guest today is the other Scott Horton. I think really he's the real Scott Horton, and I'm the other Scott Horton, but no family relation. I'm just a big fan. He writes the blog No Comment at Harper's Magazine. He's an international human rights lawyer, lectures at Columbia Law School, is the co-founder of American University in one of those stands in Central Asia, I forget, and is an all-around impressive guy and a hell of a great writer. And I welcome you back to the show, Scott. How are you doing?
Well, great to be with you. And I got to say, no, I think you're the better-known Scott Horton, you know. I got all these congratulations for the Austin Media Award when that went to you.
Oh, really? Oh, that's my
I didn't pass them on either. It was a shame. I should have, of course.
Oh, well, that's okay. And you know what? I think that's actually a good turn of events. Usually you're getting blamed for being me, and I'm getting credit for being you. So that's a nice turnaround there. So let's talk about this Jamie Lee Jones case. I think actually the first time we spoke almost 3 years ago, one of the things that we touched on was the lack of law anywhere near the contractors working for the U.S. military in Iraq, the victims of these people's criminal behavior when it occurs, basically are stuck in this terrible catch-22 where it's not American jurisdiction, it's not the military's jurisdiction, it's not the Iraqi police's jurisdiction, it's nobody's jurisdiction. And so there's been a level of impunity, basically, I think, unheard of or something, in at least in a long time. And I've read on your blog, No Comment, your testimony before the House of Representatives the other day. Was it the Senate or the House? I'm sorry.
It was the House.
It was the House, yeah. Explaining how when these kinds of things happen, basically the Justice Department, which is what it comes down to, these are the people who would have to do the prosecuting if there's going to be prosecuting. The Justice Department is completely AWOL. You have State Department investigation or a DOD investigation, but none of these people are law enforcement. And correct me if I'm wrong, you say in here that there has not been one completed prosecution of any crime by a contractor committed in the Iraqi war zone?
For any crime involving violence.
Mm-hmm.
So there have
okay.
been contracts for people with child pornography on their laptops and for contract abuses, contract fraud, things like that.
Uh-huh.
But not violent crime, nothing.
Well,
and that's against, at this point, thousands of noted cases.
At this point, there are thousands of cases known, is that what you said?
Absolutely, involving violent conduct by contractors. Not investigated, not acted upon. And I guess we got to start by saying it's not a situation where there's no law. There's a very clear law. Congress passed it. There's Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, and there's the USA Patriot Act. Both of those two statutes, amongst others, gives the U.S. Department of Justice the power and the responsibility to enforce the law with respect to contractors operating in Iraq, just as the military has a Uniform Code of Military Justice as a basis. But the Department of Justice has just adopted an attitude that we don't care. We don't want to hear anything about it. And when people go talk to them about it, they say it's the contractor's problem. Let them deal with it. And I think, you know, this case involving this very brave young woman, Jamie Lee Jones, I sat next to her during that testimony. She acquitted herself really heroically. That's the only word you could use for it. I think it just shows the tragedy that results from that grossly irresponsible attitude on the part of the Bush administration.
Well, now, you mentioned in there somewhere CPA Order 17, I think you wrote about on your blog. What's that, and does that overrule the edict of Congress? And the president signed the law passed by Congress, right?
Well, this was an order that was issued the last day that Jerry Bremer was in Baghdad before he got on the plane and flew back to the U.S. And in this order, he said all contractors in Iraq are immune from Iraqi criminal justice. So Iraqi police can't arrest them, they can't be prosecuted for crimes in the Iraqi courts, and so forth. And of course, I mean, my own view is that that was a reasonable position to take because the Iraqi criminal justice system was complete chaos, mostly because we created chaos. I mean, we had discharged all the Ba'ath Party members and everything else. The courts were a wreck. There was nothing new. So there really was no system. So giving people immunity from it, I think, was a reasonable step. But of course, that meant the U.S. needed to step in and enforce U.S. law there. So it wasn't a lawless vacuum. But the decision was made in Washington that no lawless vacuum is wonderful as far as we're concerned. That's what was created.
Uh-huh. Well, and that's sort of the story of this entire administration. Pick your topic, right?
Well, they do seem to have an amazingly hostile attitude towards the law, especially the criminal law. And I guess in my experience, it's usually criminals who have a very hostile attitude towards the criminal law.
Right. Well, there you go, I guess. And this has been the subject of your writings before you started posting where everybody could see them at Harper's and your great email list by the same name, no comment. This has really, you know, been your topic all along. Well, the basic premise of the role of government in our society, that they enforce the law, but they're bound by it too. And when there's no accountability, I think as you say on your blog today, when there's no accountability, when the law is not enforced, it encourages more lawlessness. And I guess that's really what the Republican Party in power is all about.
But, you know, it's about our revolution. If you go back to our founding fathers, if you have to reduce all the things they said and thought to one core concept, it's a very simple concept. This is a government of law, not of men. All the men in the government are accountable under the law. And this is an idea that really seems to stick in the craw of the Dick Cheneys and David Addingtons of the world, not to mention President Bush himself. You know, they're constantly acting in a way in which they put themselves above the law. And if they don't like the law, they just ignore it, presidential signing statements and so on. And then one thing I thought was just fascinating is the day on which Jamie Lee Jones is before the House committee telling her story, very emotional hearing, Justice Department is invited to send their representative and speak. They do not. Everyone's asking, where is the Attorney General Michael Mukasey, my former law partner, by the way? And Michael Mukasey is going before a meeting of the national securities lawyers at that same time, giving a speech in which he's appealing for immunity for telecommunications company on account of their criminal wrongdoing and violating the FISA statute. His number two, Judge Phillip, is gone before the Senate, in which he's in a confirmation hearing defending the practice of waterboarding, saying he won't comment on it, basically going through the exact same drill Mukasey went through in his nomination process. They have the same scriptwriter, I think I'd say. At number three, we've got his National Security Division, one of the most powerful new divisions of the Justice Department, actively involved trying to obstruct the congressional inquiry into the destruction of the CIA's tapes of the waterboarding incident. So there you see the top three people in the Justice Department involved all in activities basically upholding people who've broken the law or obstructing justice or other acts that I would put in the category of criminal. And who's involved in law enforcement, which is the topic of that hearing? No one.
Right.
It's just an absolutely appalling statement of the priorities of this department.
And now, did they actually say that they were too busy, that this was not a priority, the way you characterized earlier?
Well, they sent a brush-off letter just as the hearing got underway saying well, we have jurisdiction to deal with this, but we have an investigation going on now, and therefore it's inappropriate for us to come and speak about it. Now, of course, they weren't invited to come and speak about the Jamie Lee Jones matter. They were invited to come in and talk about what arrangements they have in place to enforce the law with respect to contractors in Iraq. And,
right.
You know, the reason they didn't send anybody is very clear. They don't have any measures in place to enforce the law in Iraq. It's a completely lawless environment. They ignore it. And, you know, nobody in the Department of Justice wanted to go up to Capitol Hill and say that.
You know, it's funny. So often when the subject or these matters of basic law, I always think back to when I was a little kid about, I was a young kid in the 80s during the Iran-Contra thing. And I remember asking, well, how come it is that the president, who, you know, to my mind was basically the king of America or whatever, how come he's hauled up there before the Congress and they're yelling at him and he's having to answer their questions like that? Oh, well, that's because there's the rule of law. And this is an idea that really appeals to, I think, particularly young boys. Right, if we're playing sports or something, we have to have all the rules laid down beforehand and not change all the rules in the middle of the game, you know, because that's the number one thing that pisses off a little boy, right, is that's not fair. You can't change the rules in the middle of the game. The rules are above all of us playing the game, and we have to go by them or else our sport, our game won't be fun anymore. Well, you know, and that's what we fight about. So these are, you know, just basic concepts. My very original understanding of how the society worked as a very young kid. Even the president is responsible to Congress. If the Department of Justice refuses to prosecute rapes under their jurisdiction, they should be removed from office. That's how it works. I learned it in fifth grade.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, it is a basic question of whether you're playing fair or whether you're a cheat. And I think the attitude we see really sort of deep in the psyche of a number of people in this administration is the psyche of a cheat. I mean, not people who believe in playing according to the law. You talked about Iran-Contra, you know, and that's really that's part of the starting point here, because, you know, some of the key figures in this administration were deeply involved in that Iran-Contra investigation on the other side of the investigation, and they felt it was abusive and it was improper, and Congress never should have been looking into what was going on, which was criminal wrongdoing at that point. And that included both Vice President Cheney and his chief of staff, David Addington, who wrote a minority report on that investigation in which they articulated this vision of a president who was above the law and not accountable. And that is now the official view of the White House.
The official view in their legal papers, even.
That's correct. I mean, and David Addington is the most influential lawyer in this administration. I mean, it's not the Attorney General and it's not Harriet Myers, you know, who, you know, I remember when she was president of the Bar Association in Texas, everybody liked Harriet Myers, but, you know, nobody really thought of her as a mental dynamo either. I mean, she's not a particularly influential person on policy. Addington is. He's the man who drives this administration on its key national security and legal policy positions.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, now tell me this. I have been led to believe that you could have an entire foundation somewhere and call it the Federalist Society, where you could actually have legal arguments. You could cite Article 2, Section something, and make a legal case for this unlimited power of the presidency. Are these people misinterpreting a clause that you read another way in the Constitution, or are they just liars? Are they just completely full of it, and they know that they're lying?
Well, I would call them, I mean, there were a class of philosophers back in antiquity who were known as the sophists. And the sophists said, give us any proposition you want. We can concoct an argument to support it and try and go out and persuade people of that. And, you know, the people like John Yoo are the ultimate sophist. They will take the position now that, you know, their party is in power, that the president is all powerful. When the other party is in power, they will do a 180-degree turn and take exactly the opposite position. And John Yoo, in fact, has specifically done that. You know, he advocated that the powers of Bill Clinton were extremely limited. He couldn't do anything. But as soon as George Bush comes to power, it's all-powerful presidency. And he's written two very thick books in which he talks about historical precedent and how at the time of the American Revolution, people wanted to see this robust, all-powerful president with powers more or less the same as those of the British monarch or greater. And, of course, when you go and you look at that book and you look at the sources he's citing, you see, yes, it's absolutely true at the time of the American Revolution there were people who thought that way. They were wearing red uniforms and fighting for Britain.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and he has the chutzpah to trot this out as our legal legacy, our historical legacy. It's outrageous.
Yeah, patriotism as deference to King George.
That's right.
Wow. And, you know, to what you were saying about the lessons of Iran-Contra, I think it was Seymour Hersh reported that they threw a little party, right? Eric Edelman and everybody came together, and they talked about the lessons of Iran-Contra, and the lessons really were run everything out of the vice president's office, you know, get John Yoo to Buffalo through the law as best you can. But when it comes to outright breaking the law, do it out of a off-the-books cabal in the vice president's office, and no one can touch you.
And don't leave a paper trail anywhere. And, you know, if there's one really underreported news story this week that people ought to be focusing on, it's that very suspicious fire that occurred in Vice President Cheney's office earlier this week.
Oh, now why don't you elaborate on that? Because I only saw the headline, didn't even read about it at all.
Well, it occurred in the executive office building and Vice President Cheney's ceremonial office. The official report is that it was an electrical fire, damaged completely one office. And, you know, okay, well, so maybe it is as is officially reported, but I would just say a healthy dose of skepticism is necessary. I mean, look what's going on in Washington right now. We've got a huge scandal unfolding surrounding waterboarding and the role that the White House played in approving it. That was all laid out by John Kerouac, who, by the way, they just launched an FBI investigation into. You know, he's being investigated for having the audacity to publicly tell the truth about the White House's involvement in this.
That's
and as soon as all this gets into the headlines, suddenly we have this mysterious fire in Vice President Cheney's office. Well, you know, maybe it's just a fire as a result of an electrical overload, and maybe it's not.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that the Justice Department will dispatch investigators over there, probably, or maybe the Treasury will send some ATF guys to round up some evidence. What do you think?
I think the conclusions of that investigation have already been written.
Oh, okay. All right, now let's talk about waterboarding. You know, for some reason, I think that even in my mind somewhere, there's been this sort of vague notion that, well, and I think the administration really has been successful in portraying it this way, that, well, you know, hooking a car battery to somebody's genitals or just, you know, completely beating them or whipping them, starving them, you know, the pulling their fingernails out, screws in the thumbs, these kinds of things we would never do. But, yeah, the occasional waterboarding, you know, that's necessary. And it makes it seem as though waterboarding is a lesser torture maybe than some other tortures. And yet I read this thing the other day about waterboarding. And, in fact, well, I read a few different things the other day. One of them was about an American Army veteran who was forced to undergo waterboarding in training, and who said it completely ruined his life. This was in, I think, the early 70s, and how he still just has nightmares over and over. And basically what they're doing is they're killing you. They get you all the way to the death spiral where you are actually dying, literally dying. Not you are made to feel like you are drowning. You are literally drowning and dying, and then at the last second they save your life and bring you back just until you calm down enough that they can do it again. Do I understand this right? Is this out of, you know, ancient China, or what are we doing here?
Yeah, well, you understand it exactly right. I mean, the administration likes to say it's simulated drowning. It's not. It's drowning. You're literally drowning someone, and you try and stop just short of actually killing them. But the trauma is extremely severe. It's very physical. And this is a torture technique that can be dated back to ancient times, one of the oldest recorded ones. But one thing, if we just go back to the English tradition, and that is the one that our country comes from, 17th century, time we had all those nasty, haughty Stuart monarchs. One of them, of course, was James the First, the guy who ordered the preparation of the Bible. He had all sorts of moral qualms about torture, but nevertheless, he allowed it to happen. He would give orders for it, and he wrote an account that was called The King's Book, 1606, in which he talks about the use of these different torture techniques. And there are three major techniques he discusses there: thumb screws, the rack, and waterboarding. And there's a definite scheme used for them. So thumb screws is the least serious. Then second, so if the thumb screws don't work, then you proceed to the rack. That's the second most serious. And if the rack doesn't work, even the rack doesn't work, you go to the most serious torture technique, which, in their view, was waterboarding. Because waterboarding is not causing people mere physical pain. It's essentially coming one step short of killing them by drowning, right?
Yeah,
that was the most severe technique that would be used. And he would only authorize the use of waterboarding if thumb screws and the rack didn't work. Then you go to the ultimate technique. So, you know, the administration always wants people to think now that, oh, waterboarding, you know, it's something clinical. And what was it that Dick Cheney said? It's like bobbing for apples in the county fair. You know, that's total nonsense, ridiculous. It's attempting to make something that is extremely serious and life-threatening appear to be trivial.
Didn't you write one time about a story about George Washington at a camp during the American Revolution, and he came upon some of his Continental soldiers torturing some captured British soldiers, and he put them up against the wall on the spot?
Well, that's right. In fact, we're coming up on the anniversary of that. That happened on Christmas Day, 1776. The battle, Princeton and Trenton, these two conflicts. And the Hessians were taken prisoner in Trenton.
So wait, this is the battle with the famous painting of Washington standing in the boat crossing the Delaware.
That's right.
Okay.
That was when he crossed over from Valley Forge to go into New Jersey to fight that battle. So that's immediately before. So this was considered to be the pivotal event in the early year of the Revolution. The Americans were on the verge of being completely crushed. This was what's referred to by historians of the Revolutionary War as the Christmas miracle. When the American Revolution came back, and scored this decisive victory. And this decisive victory involved them for the first time capturing a battalion of German mercenaries who were fighting for King George. And these mercenaries had been really bad boys. I mean, they had been raping and plundering all across the Hudson Valley of New York and northern New Jersey. And so the soldiers wanted to take revenge, and they set them up to do what was called running the gauntlet. That's where soldiers would stand on two sides. They make the prisoners run between, and they would hit them with sticks and stones. And Washington saw this was about to happen, and he intervened and said, "This will not happen. I will not permit people who are in our custody to be mistreated in any way. They're going to be treated with dignity and respect." And then he later wrote out an order in which he said, "First, treat them with humanity." And his view was, we're a democratic society. A democratic society values the dignity of individual human beings. And it doesn't matter whether they're our citizens or they're the enemy. A tyranny, a tyrannical society, puts no value on individual human life. They're just fodder for them, so they don't care about torture. And he said, our values will help us win this war, because by the end of the war, these soldiers will see the merit of our way and our traditions, and they'll be fighting for us. And that's true. By the end of the war, most of the Hessians actually volunteered to fight in the Continental Army alongside their, you know, their former American adversaries. And hardly a man of those Hessians returned back to Germany. They settled in the United States. And, you know, this is a big part of the population, the descendants of those people, parts of the Hudson Valley, and also in northeastern Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. And now, and the punishment, George Washington's punishment for people who disobeyed his order?
He said that anyone who disobeys this order should be subjected to the most severe punishment, and indeed, if the gravity of the offense merited it, to include the death sentence.
Well,
which,
you
in
go.
Fact, was done in some instances where they found prisoners being mistreated.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, well, we've come a long way, huh?
Well, I'd say the current George W. Does not in any way resemble his predecessor.
All right, now, speaking of which, and this goes to that immunity question. In fact, help me out, because I'm really not that good on the British history. Was it Charles I who said that he had sovereign immunity, and everybody said, oh, well, that's great, and then they cut his head off, and then said to the next guy, you don't?
Yeah, he's the man who said, the king is the law, rex est lex, he said in Latin. And therefore, if I say it, that is the law. So therefore, there's no way the king can violate the law. That's not a possibility. And the reaction of the court, the judicial commissioners who tried his case, was to say, no, the king is not above the law. No man is above the law. And they sentenced him to be executed.
And now this is the same kind of sovereign immunity that government officials claim in this country, right? I mean, going back to 1992, Lon Horiuchi, the FBI sniper that blew that lady's head off at Ruby Ridge, the state tried to prosecute him, and the federal government then said, no, we'll handle this case, and transferred it to federal court, and then dismissed all the charges because they said, we can't prosecute this guy. He has sovereign immunity. He was on the clock when he blew that lady's head off.
That's right, and that guy is someone who had a terrible track record previously in the FBI. That wasn't the first instance.
He was a sniper at Waco
right.
A year later,
concept,
too.
We have, over American history, we've seen this concept of immunity of the sovereign, which spreads out, you know, beyond just the president and vice president and many other people. We see it like a roller coaster going way up and then coming way down. But I would say the spirit of the founding fathers was not in favor of sovereign immunity. They really did not like this idea. In fact, when the revolution occurred in France and King Louis the 16th was executed, there was a big hue and cry in America about the idea of sovereign immunity, that, you know, this shouldn't happen to a sovereign. And that's when Thomas Jefferson made that speech saying that the tree of liberty every now and then had to be watered with a fresh helping of blood. And he saw no problem at all with a monarch being held accountable under the law, tried and executed.
Mm-hmm. And now we have the government not just claiming immunity for themselves, but passing immunity around for their co-conspirators and their crimes against us. Last time I checked, the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution in plain English forbids the executive branch from committing searches against people in this country unless an independent judicial authority says it's okay based on probable cause. And I'm fairly certain there's a big fat period at the end of that sentence there, the Fourth Amendment. And as you've been covering and others like Glenn Greenwald, the U.S. Congress is doing everything they can to help the Bush administration spread their sovereign immunity out to the telecoms who have helped them violate our rights.
Well, I think you got to start with what you ended with there. That is that this started on an initiative of the Bush administration. They wanted, and this antedates 9/11. We now know that very clearly. It goes back to the very beginning of the Bush administration. They wanted to introduce new devices that use this logarithmic data mining to go through everybody's telephone communications, everybody's email communications, everybody's web surfing. After 9/11, they figured that the opportunity was there to do it, and they went and started talking to the telecoms. And several of the telecoms said, basically, well, if you want it, we'll cooperate with you. You know, my belief is that they were looking for some sort of memorandum from the Attorney General to tell them that this was lawful before they did it, but it clearly wasn't lawful because the law, the Constitution, and also the FISA statute says very clearly a court has to issue a warrant. Very, very limited exceptions to that. And they weren't getting warrants for this stuff. Very interestingly, one telecom company said no, Quest. And what happened? Quest was up and thought it had some major National Security Administration contracts, and suddenly they lost those contracts. And the next thing they knew, Mr. Natsios, who's the CEO of Quest, who was the man who relayed the word that we won't work with you, discovered that he was under criminal investigation for insider trading.
You mean the Justice Department found the time?
Oh, yes, evidently. You know, so people who get in the way of, you know, one of the highest priority, which is snooping on people in this country, find themselves almost immediately the target of a criminal investigation. And he was tried and convicted. He's now up on appeal. And I just thought, you know, again, you know, of course it's purely coincidental. I mean, no one would suggest that the Bush administration would launch a vindictive criminal prosecution against the telecom CEO because he refused to play that game.
It almost seems at times that this administration is racing just to set precedents, that if they can just commit outrage after outrage after outrage in such a frequency that we can never do anything about any of them, then the precedents are all set. That, you know, it's just like George Bush likes to cite Lincoln. Well, Lincoln can invade a state, I can too. Lincoln can suspend habeas corpus, I can too. It's the same thing. He, I guess, wants the next few presidents to be able to say, well, if George Bush can do it, why can't I?
Well, I think what we see that, you know, particularly what this administration has done in the area of justice is, in most respects, unprecedented. I mean, there is no body of precedent they can go back to historically, decided the basis for many of the things they've done. You know, the closest historical antecedents probably are about the 1790s, what Thomas Jefferson called the reign of witches. You know, that's the period in high federalism when the Federalists started launching criminal prosecutions of their enemies, you know, alien and sedition acts and all that. And so, you know, what they're doing is in some ways quite akin to that. And then you would sort of cherry pick through many, many different administrations and pick out the most egregious and abusive things that occurred in those administrations. And you find, of course, Bush will immediately cite that as a precedent to try and do it himself. So, but the amalgam is just stunning.
Yeah, it really is. Especially when you talk about, correct me if I'm wrong, when we're talking about this Jamie Lee Jones story. This girl from Houston worked for KBR, allegedly, credibly, sounds like to me, her accusations, was raped by KBR employees. She called her father, who called a Republican congressman, and said something's got to be done about this. But, you know, this girl might as well have been Jessica Lynch, right? This is the poster child for all that is good, true, and beautiful in America is the young blonde girl. And this is why it's okay we're bombing you, in fact, is because we're using pretty young blonde girls to bomb you. And here a Republican congressman, I guess, intervened in this case and got her home safely, but apparently has been silent this whole time, has been unable to get the administration or the Justice Department to get in gear at all about this case.
Well, I'll tell you, I was, you know, at that Judiciary Committee hearing, there were quite a few Republicans there, There was no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans on this issue. In fact, the Republicans were trying to outdo the Democrats, an expression of rage of what had happened. Judge Gohmert from Texas was there. Congressman Poe was there. Several others. So I think certainly the Republicans who've tracked and really watched what's gone on are outraged about it. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't seem to make any difference with the Justice Department and the Bush administration.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, this case is years old, right?
It's 2.5 years old. 2.5 years, right? And the Justice Department opens a file and starts dealing with it about the time they're told that Congress is going to have a hearing on this.
Yeah.
So they can, and they basically do this in order to be able to say, oh, well, we can't testify. It's a pending matter.
Of course. That's what they always do, right?
That happens pretty often, I have to say. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Now, there's another story that you've covered at your blog, No Comment, at Harper's Magazine's website, in great detail. And this is a story that I actually haven't followed too closely, but I got a pretty good background briefing from Larissa Alexandrovna from Raw Story about it last night. And that's the story of Don Siegelman in Alabama. And what amounts to, well, she said this kind of thing really worried her because she grew up in the Soviet Union. And she knows what it's like when there's really no pretense of a rule of law, and people who dare stand in the way are ruthlessly oppressed. And she said this is the kind of thing that makes her really fret for the future of this country, when basically the Karl Rove political machine is locking up governors they don't like, having making up criminal prosecutions of their political opposition. Are we moving toward a one-party state here? Are they getting away with this?
Well, I think that, you know, we start with the fact that that in the area of public integrity investigations, there were six investigations opened with respect to Democrats for every one opened against a Republican, okay? So what's the statistical chance that this would happen in some random way when the number of Democrats versus the number of Republicans in the country and public office is in rough parity, a few more Democrats, not a lot more, roughly in parity, and the odds are, you know, 1 in 10,000 that this could happen by chance. So this is the result of a conscious design and program to use the Justice Department to attack the administration's political adversaries. There's no other way to do it. In fact, the most prominent former Republican Attorney General, Dick Thornburgh, went before Congress and testified under oath that he was absolutely persuaded that this administration was engaged in using the criminal justice system to persecute its political adversaries, namely Democrats. Now, the most stunning case of many, and there's several dozen cases that I've been tracking, the most stunning case involves this governor of Alabama, Don Siegelman. In fact, my family comes from Alabama, and I'll tell you, they're all Republicans, and they all hate Don Siegelman, and I got into this by hearing, you know, some of my relatives down there say, you know, something really wrong about this case. It's crooked. And I started looking at it, and this said, by the way, by someone who detests Don Siegelman, I started looking at it and realizing that, yes, it was horrible. It stank to high heaven. And then we had a Republican political operative named Jill Simpson come forward and recount the involvement of Karl Rove in this case. She describes a conversation at which Karl Rove's involvement is set out in some detail, and Karl Rove is quoted as saying he talked to the Justice Department, and a political Alabama political operative present in the room named Bill Canary says, "My girls are going to get Siegelman. This man is the husband of the U.S. attorney in Montgomery who brought the case." So it stinks. They brought it. They rigged it. They brought in a federal judge who's a brand-new Bush appointee, also a man who had political connections to Rove, to sit as the judge in the case. And this man used every ounce of judicial discretion to get a conviction based on evidence that I believe is bogus, and that the prosecutors knew was bogus when they introduced it in order to get their political kill. And all this is coming unraveled right now.
Well, now, wasn't part of the story, too, that there was a whistleblower inside the opponent's camp who wound up dead or missing or something?
Well, they're actually, at this point, as best I can count, there are three whistleblowers inside the camp of the Republican Party of Alabama who've come forward. One of the three is well known because she's actually given interviews and so forth. There are two more who are still maintaining their anonymity. But as a result of that, we've got a very good picture of what's going on. The one who came forward, wound up having her car driven off the road and totaled. Her mother's house was burned down with a very suspicious fire. And then on top of all that, Governor Siegelman's home was broken into twice.
But this young lady, this whistleblower whose car was run off the road, she wasn't killed, though.
She was not killed, no.
Okay.
No.
Okay,
not yet. And Governor Siegelman's attorney's offices were broken in. And the burglars weren't interested in her VCR and television set or her liquor, but they wanted to go through her legal files.
Wow. And now you say there are dozens of these, several dozen cases like this?
Absolutely. There's the case of Charles Walker in Georgia. There's the case of Paul Miner in Mississippi. Judge Diaz, Judge Teal, Judge Westfield in Mississippi. There's a very, very high-profile case out in Wisconsin. There's a major case that occurred in New Mexico. So we have these cases going on all over the country. Politically targeted cases. A whole series of cases involving trial lawyers whose offices were raided with the approval of the Attorney General, about 8 of these cases. And what's the crime these trial lawyers were guilty of? They were raising money for John Edwards.
Uh-huh.
At one case in Michigan, I'm told there were 50 FBI agents deployed to raid this office on the crime of raising money for John Edwards. One of the FBI agents described that he had been recalled from working in Iraq to be in on this raid.
Really?
This gives you a sense of what the priorities of the administration are, because, of course, our hearing was all about the fact that there was no law enforcement going on in Iraq. And, of course, what's more important for them? Oh, yes, having agent number 50 being in the law office raid of persons suspected of raising money for a Democratic politician.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Greg Palast has covered this, too, and he talks about Bill Richardson turning a blind eye because the Democrats being thwarted in his state were from the opposing faction of Democrats. And so he went ahead and let the Republicans get away with some of their shenanigans there.
Yeah, I think the case, of course, on December 7th, 2006, when the U.S. attorney scandal broke out, we had those 7 U.S. attorneys, originally 6, later 7. And David Iglesias, who was the U.S. attorney in Albuquerque, his case, I think, is the big bombshell out of all of them. Because when I have an article that's going to be coming out about this shortly, but I'll just go right to the punchline. What we discover at the end of this case is the man who decided to fire Iglesias because he wouldn't bring the prosecution of this Democrat in Santa Fe right on the eve of the election was President Bush personally.
Really?
Alberto Gonzalez refused to do it because it was so flagrantly wrong and a violation of the law. They went into the Oval Office and got Bush to do it. That's one of the reasons we're seeing such stonewalling in the investigation in Congress right now, because the trail goes right into the Oval Office.
Wow. What might be fun would be to just sit down for a few hours and draw up some articles of impeachment.
Well, a lot of people have talked about that. Of course, one thing you have to worry about, if you impeach Bush, then you've got Dick Cheney as president.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call that an improvement.
Yeah, well, and I guess it's probably too late now, this far into the presidential campaign season and all that kind of thing. I guess the only way I can imagine it would be if they removed them both and then Pelosi swore that she wasn't running for anything. She was only keeping the seat warm till 2009 for whoever won in 2008. But it's too late for that now, isn't it?
Well, there's another way of thinking of it, and that is, throughout America's history, the few cases where there has been a pushback of executive power has been when a president was threatened with impeachment very credibly. You have, the case with President Polk over the Mexican War, where there was a big move towards his impeachment. That led to a rollback in presidential authority. You have the case with Andrew Johnson right after the Civil War. And then you've got, of course, the Nixon case and the Watergate era. So those are really the 3 points, the only 3 points I know of in American history where presidential power was rolled back. I think a lot of people looking at it would say, we're way past due for a big rollback in presidential power, and this is the only historically demonstrated way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. Although, I guess after World War I, there was a bit of a rollback, right?
Well, I mean, you had a change in parties in office, and we had, you know, Republicans at that point who were really quite committed to less power, and we also had President Wilson, who was totally disabled at the end of the war.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, now, and speaking of, you know, trying to roll back executive power, it occurs to me that you would make a pretty good attorney general in a Ron Paul administration. Have you considered that?
Well, I have to say, I had a chat very recently with my good friend Andrew Sullivan, and I complimented him on writing his endorsement of Ron Paul, and I told him, which I thought was excellent. I hope all your viewers go and read it. I'm constantly listening to the Republican debates, and when I hear them, I only hear two Republicans ever say things that make sense to me, and that's Ron Paul and John McCain. I disagree with McCain about an awful lot of things, but, you know, he does strike me as a sincere statesman-like figure. And Ron Paul, I agree with on probably more things than any Republican candidate. So there you go. I mean, he's definitely somebody I respect. And I congratulate you for giving mainstream media hell for their failure to seriously cover his campaign. I'm, always amazed by that.
Yeah, it really is incredible, the blackout. Although, you know, it was a strategic compromise, I guess, to hold the last fundraiser on the 16th. It's a great anniversary, and it raised a lot of money. But it was a Sunday, which means all the reporters were off, and it kind of cost us some news coverage there, especially dealing with a media that is, you know, has to be pulled kicking and screaming to cover the campaign at all.
But when I'm out traveling, and especially when I'm on college campuses, I see Ron Paul signs and posters everywhere. I mean, really, more of that than anybody else's campaign paraphernalia.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Naomi Wolf wrote this, I think it was Naomi Wolf or Naomi Klein, I get them confused. One of them wrote a great blog entry at the Huffington Post about Ron Paul's American Freedom Agenda Act of 2007, which bans torture, repeals the Military Commissions Act, guarantees the writ of habeas corpus for everybody, and protects journalists who print classified information, and on and on and on like that. And, you know, I read that, and that seemed to, you know, kind of be right up your alley for an agenda for what to repeal as soon as possible.
Well, I think it's right. I am familiar with that. I mean, you know, I my own instincts on most issues are very much with the libertarians. So, yeah. The one thing I have a little bit of trouble with is on the tax side. I'm really concerned about the massive debt that's been rolled up in the United States. And, you know, one thing people have got to focus on is the fact that since George W. Bush became president, our national indebtedness has been increased by $32 trillion. That's 150% of what the debt was when he came to office.
Obligations into the future? Or
That's right. That includes a forecast of obligations that have arisen but go into the future. And that's according to a speech that was delivered earlier this week by the Comptroller of the United States, the head of the Government mm-hmm. Accounting Office. I think a absolutely stunning number, you know, reflecting the staggering burden that Bush is putting the country under, and something that got no coverage in the media, none. Yeah. It was like, we don't want to hear about that, you know. Let's talk about Jacko's mummification.
Yeah, I saw where you wrote about that on your blog. Now tell me, this Comptroller General, what's his name?
I'm sorry, his name is slipping my mind.
That's
right.
I forget too.
He's the head of the GAO, and right. You know, he issues these reports every year, but this one was particularly dramatic.
Yeah, well, and he's the guy who came out just a month or two ago and said, listen, we're going the way of the Roman Empire here. We can either be a republic or an empire, but not both, and we ought to make our choice here pretty quick before it's too late.
Well, one of the problems is we have nobody on the public stage talking about fiscal accountability. It just doesn't happen anymore. I remember back during the Clinton administration, you know, you would pick up any weekly issue of the Wall Street Journal and open to the editorial page, and there'd be a long lecture about fiscal accountability.
Mm-hmm.
Today, nobody talks about it.
Yep. Well,
that's
except
dangerous.
For Dr. Paul.
Yeah.
Dr. Paul focuses on that quite a bit, although I don't know if he talks about the debt itself right off the bat, but he does talk about, you know, government spending far more than they can tax us without a revolt, and so then they resort to borrowing and printing the money out of nothing and debasing our currency and promote sound money as an alternative. So
All of that's true. I mean, I think, you know, one of the problems we're facing right now is that, you know, we've got to start taking down this debt. It's horrendous. I don't see any way we're going to be able to do that without increasing the tax burden. Basically, we're going to wind up upping the tax burden to cover all of the obligations that were incurred in the Bush administration.
Yeah. Well, or we can just close down our 700-something military bases around the world.
I have a suspicion that's going to happen pretty quickly. I just don't see that as being sustainable.
Yeah. All right, well, I'll look forward to your opinion issued from the Attorney General's office defending the policy when it goes down next year.
Well, I can tell you one thing. Waterboarding is torture and is illegal. That would be my opinion number one.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it would, and I'm sure that that the White House would adopt it immediately. Hey, everybody, Scott Horton, the other Scott Horton, the real Scott Horton, he writes for Harper's Magazine. He's probably America's most adamant opponent of torture, and his great blog is called No Comment. Thanks a lot for your time today, Scott.
Great to be with you.